Hello and welcome to GCSE English Revision Pod. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you, listener, and to you, Mr. Forster.
Merry Christmas. It's not quite New Year yet. Nearly, but not quite.
Nearly. We're in the nether zone. We're in those strange,
liminal,
ethereal few days where nothing seems to mean anything, where it's really foggy today as well where I am, actually. So it has got that slightly sort of mysterious feel to the day. We want to apologise, listeners, for our long gap and sort of lack of episodes. We've obviously, in the crazy year that is 2020, we've both had to adapt quite a lot in our, and do lots of different things. And unfortunately, podcasting has taken a bit of a back seat. But Mr. Forster, we have a New Year's resolution, don't we?
To do more.
To do more podcasts, right?
Yeah, we aim to not just more in general. I mean, actually, that's also my New Year's resolution, is to do more generally, because just not really.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great resolution, though, because it's very difficult to hold you to account on it. Do more,
More than what?
Well, I have done more. I've done more sitting. I've watched more Netflix. You know, it's easy to easy to do more. Right, so we're going to jump straight in. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, the format of GCSE English Revision Pod is we will go through a question on a GCSE set text. We will talk you through how, if this particular essay came up, we would write the essay response. However, the podcasts are not limited particularly to this one question, as a lot of the stuff we will talk about would be useful in other questions as well, but we will be using one particular question to structure what we say. Generally, Mr. Forster will say incredibly clever things from his that he's learned from his wonderful education and, you know, all the things that come out of his mighty brain, and then I will then try and boil them down into things that that we can all understand. What do you think about that, Sam?
I think it's very kind.
I think it's a good system.
I mean, the other thing really, just to underline for people that haven't listened before, is what we're really trying to do is not teach you how to answer just one question, because the chances of this particular question coming up are so slim. It's more about the approach to any question. The idea of actually, a lot of revision resources out there, I feel, just, you know, give you some facts but don't tell you what to do with them. We try and teach you how to write an essay.
Absolutely. And what you'll realize is the more essays that you plan, the more crossover that you will notice. I always say this to my students: when you're a great way to revise is to think about, say, 10 different questions from a set text, and then just do a really quick little essay plan for each question. So this is what I would talk about if we're doing Romeo and Juliet today. So if a question about Romeo came up, I would write these three arguments. If a question about love came up, I would write these three arguments. If you do 10 or 15 of those, you will very quickly realize that the same parts of the play are featuring again and again. And if you realize that, right, the same part of the play is appearing in 7 or 8 of the essay plans I've just made, it's a very good idea to become very familiar with that part of the play.
So should we crack on with the question for today? So the extract we're looking at from today is from Act 3, Scene 2 of Romeo and Juliet. So if you haven't yet downloaded the handout, dear listener, we suggest you go into the description on whatever podcast app you're listening on of the episode. And in there, there should be...
Or YouTube.
And in that description, there should be a link that you can click on to a Google Doc, which will have our handout. That handout has the question, it has the extract, it has the key vocabulary, it has the thesis, it has our argument, all the stuff you need.
And all completely for free.
I know. Brilliant.
Exactly what you need at this this time of year. Right, so the question that you've chosen, you say it looks at Act 3, Scene 2.
Yeah, so just to contextualise the extract, if you can't remember what happens then, Act 3, Scene 1 is really the centre of the play. I always call it the pivot or the fulcrum around which the whole play turns. It's when Mercutio and Tybalt both die. Tybalt kills Mercutio and Romeo, out of vengeance, kills Tybalt. And the play shifts, it lurches from comedy, this world of jokes, this world of happiness, this world of love, towards tragedy. The only end that seems possible is tragedy. And this scene takes place immediately afterwards. And we have Juliet, this 13-year-old girl, a couple of weeks off her 14th birthday, waiting for Romeo, who she's just married, to come to her bedroom to consummate their relationship.
There's a very strong sense of dramatic irony here then, because the audience know that this transition has happened. The audience know that something terrible has happened, and that the man that Juliet loves is now an exiled murderer. But of course, the character on the stage has no knowledge of this yet, and is still wrapped up in the excitement and the beauty of love.
Yeah, so I find it a really sad moment, a really poignant moment, because she doesn't yet know. And so the question we're looking at is, starting with this exchange, explore how Shakespeare presents Juliet in Romeo and Juliet.
So all right, so it's a nice simple character question, which may come up. You sometimes get a theme, you sometimes get a character, you sometimes get how a character relates to something in the play, but we're going for a straight up character question today.
Yeah. And obviously, if a question on Juliet came up, it may not be this extract, but actually what you can always do with your essay plans, you can shift things around, that if it started with a different extract, you could actually write about this moment later on. So I think this is a really interesting moment that just shows her vulnerability. She's so different from the rest of the Veronese citizens that we encounter, and yet she's vulnerable. There's nothing she can do in the face of what's happening.
Right.
So we always start with a thesis, don't we? Why, Mr. Geller, can you explain? Why do we start with a thesis statement? Why do we call an introduction this fancy schmancy word? What are we trying to do?
What we're trying to do with a thesis statement is we're trying to say right from the get-go of our essay that this is an argument that we are going to make. What we're not going to do, and what students fall into the trap of doing sometimes, is just saying, right, here's a moment where we see Juliet. Here's another moment in the play where we see Juliet being a bit different. And here's another moment in the play where we see Juliet being either different or the same, perhaps. That's not really an argument, right? That's just showing that we're aware of that character being in the play. A thesis statement explores how the writer, in this case Shakespeare, uses that character in the play. And what we're saying to the reader of our essay is, right from the get-go, we are making an argument about the way that a character is used. We are making an argument about how a character is a device that teaches the audience a message, or shows them something,
or just provokes an emotional reaction.
Provokes a reaction, right, absolutely. But a strong thesis statement will get you straight into the examiner's good books, because they'll think, right, okay, here's a student who had an idea. They knew that this character was not just a character within a story. They knew that this character was designed to do something, and here they're going to explore it.
What we're avoiding is just giving useless contextual information about the name of Shakespeare's son, or, you know, we don't care about any of that stuff. What we care about is straight away the question. So let's read the thesis statement. So although only 13 years old, there is a surprising complexity to Juliet. She's arguably the only character able to transcend the violent and dysfunctional world of 14th century Verona, a world of senseless violence and ineffectual patriarchs into which even Romeo is drawn. This extract, taken from Act 3, Scene 2, is defined by the pathos of Juliet's erotic longing as she waits for her wedding night, not yet knowing of the deaths of Tybalt and Mercutio, which has shifted the play inexorably towards tragedy.
Very nice. Now, you can see there are some highlighted words in that thesis statement. All the key vocabulary is included in the handout. We should start off with this idea then that Juliet transcends the violent and dysfunctional world of Verona, meaning, of course, that she is able to go beyond it, right? That she is not drawn into the stupidity, the pointless feud between the Capulets and the Montagues. She is someone who is able to find true love rather than the toxic version of love we saw from Mercutio and also from the servants at the start of the play. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the bit at the start of the play reminds me of like year 11s in the playground, doesn't it? Life hasn't really changed in 400 odd years. But whereas Juliet, she's risen above that. She's transcended it. So the other words we might not know is, of course, the idea of patriarch. So this is a world governed by men. A patriarch is a man in a position of authority. That's why we get the adjective patriarchal when we talk about a patriarchal society. It's men in positions of power.
Yeah.
The other words that they might not have encountered before, pathos, is, I think, a really useful word here, particularly for this scene. If something evokes pathos, it evokes feeling. It's a Greek word. It's the feelings of sympathy or pity that a work of art can evoke. And I think we certainly get that with Juliet here with the dramatic irony, as you said.
Right, so the deep sorrow that the audience is feeling for Juliet at that time.
Yeah, we see a girl who's transcended the world she's in, and yet she's also at the same time being drawn into that world. She's going to feel the consequences of this. Her husband...
Through no fault of her own as well.
Yeah. So as always, with these kind of questions from AQA or whichever exam board you do, if it's an extract question, the logical place to start is with the extract, isn't it?
Of course.
You've got it there in the exam in front of you. You don't even have to think, you can get straight into it. One thing you can't do, of course, is you can't analyze every single thing in the extract. So you're going to have to make some decisions as to what you analyze and what you choose to leave out. So, yeah, what were you going to say?
Just worth saying, both with your language and your literature GCSEs, that idea of being judicious, of being clever with the detail you select, is a huge part of it, really. Actually, we think that analysis and contextual links to that analysis are where success is, and that is true to a huge degree. But really, if you've not selected the best quotations to talk about, you've made that job a thousand times harder for yourself, really, haven't you? Selecting the best, the richest pieces of language, the most meaningful pieces of language, is already putting yourself in a very strong position.
Yeah, so my first kind of paragraph, the argument I think that this extract shows is this. I've written a topic sentence. So we always call the first sentence of each paragraph a topic sentence. It's like a mini thesis. It's summarizing what are you arguing at this point in your essay. And what I've said is this. This extract is so moving precisely because it depicts the way in which Juliet stands apart from the empty feud of the Montagues and Capulets and from the patriarchal structures of Venice. What does that mean?
To me, it seems that there's an irony here that it's such a young character and such a young female character in a world that's dominated by men, as you were saying before, is one of the wisest characters we've so far seen. I mean, even though she's head over heels in love, and you could argue that she's fallen in love in what you might consider quite an immature, childish way, her belief in the good things in life and her belief in meaning seems to actually take her beyond this stupid battle of a world that she's born into, right? And that actually she is like a beacon of hope in the play.
Unlike other women, she's not an object in some kind of masculine exchange. She's not something to be passed around men, even though Paris tries this. He goes to her father to ask for a hand in marriage. What we see in this speech, this soliloquy, is that she has choice. She has desire. She fancies Roman. She doesn't just want him to be with him on a spiritual level. She wants him in her bed.
She knows what she wants and she knows how to get it.
Yeah, and I think what the first thing I'd like to consider here is something students often don't think about, and that's the staging of the scene. Like what the scene would actually look like on stage. And I think if you haven't done this already, the Globe have got a production, actually, I believe, of Romeo and Juliet on YouTube at the moment you can watch. And it's well worth watching what it would have looked like on Shakespeare's stage, because this is a scene that's often staged on the balcony. The same balcony, of course, that the famous Act Two, Scene One would have been staged on. So you can almost imagine this visual echo here of the moment when Romeo and Juliet truly express their love for each other on the balcony. It's a place of erotic anticipation. It's close to her bedchamber. But it's also, I think, crucially, this is my point, it's a place above the stage. If you imagine this on stage, Act Three, Scene One has ended with bodies strewing the stage, the main stage. And Juliet comes on. Of it, we see visually in terms of the staging how this is usually staged, the idea of her rising above above this violence. She's separate, she's in this different world,
right? Okay, so she's physically visually separate from the terrible fight that's been happening, and yet you could take the metaphor further because she's about to be dragged down into it, right?
She literally will walk down from the balcony when she talks to the nurse in this scene. She will literally come down from this place of transcendence in this scene.
Back into the mire and the mess that is Verona at that time. Right.
And I think that it echoes in the language as well. Like her language echoes Romeo's metaphors from earlier in the play, this celestial imagery to do with stars, to do with the moon. She talks about Romeo, he's the day and night. She imagines him as little stars that will make the face of heaven so fine that we will worship the garish sun no longer. You know, she even says a simile that I believe that you noticed this back when we were both teaching the same school, that she talks about him being like the new snow on a raven's back, which reminds us of Romeo in Act 1, Scene 5, when he talks about her being a snowy dove trooping with crows. All of her imagery echoes Romeo's imagery, doesn't it?
And it also you could argue perhaps it's the first time in the play where metaphor actually starts to mean something, because we have been introduced previously to Romeo's use of empty imagery. You know, of course, the famous old brawling love, oh loving hate, oh anything of nothing. You know, there's that whole section where Romeo gives what feels on the surface like poignant imagery. But when you pick it apart, as we did in a previous episode, you find that there's a bit of a lack of meaning there, that a lot of Romeo's words don't actually mean anything. But here, now that love and Juliet in particular has entered the play, we suddenly see the same start of language actually start to kind of work and actually start to take on that meaning. And we see Juliet as bringing that meaning perhaps to the play.
I think, Christy, here, the point you might want to unpack a little bit further is that her imagery here is erotically charged. It is something particularly uncomfortable for us to imagine a 13-year-old having these thoughts, of course. And we've got to remember, in early modern society, it was legal for girls to marry as young as 12, boys to marry at 14. Although the average marital age was, of course, 26 or 28, so not that different to now. But it's deeply uncomfortable for us. So we have to put that aside for a moment and imagine just a different world, really, from ours. But her image is erotically charged. When she talks about the night being a curtain to be spread, she's imagining the bed, because beds in early modern society were surrounded by curtains, mainly for sleeping purposes. Her world is like collapsing into this single bed where she imagines that they will lose a pair of stainless maidenhead. She's talking about losing virginity. She's talking about and there's perhaps even something, you know, sexually explicit about the idea of this kind of spread curtain. You know, this is imagery that she's imagining sex, isn't she? That's what she's preparing, that's what she's thinking
about. Yeah. And you could argue again that there's perhaps a depiction of maturity in it. Well, in one sense, no, of course, because she's such a young girl, and like you say, it feels incredibly uncomfortable to a modern audience. But perhaps to the audience of the time, the fact that she, because we've already had the nurse sort of hint at this earlier in the play, the fact that Juliet is seeing this as something that will be pleasurable for her, is something that she desires, is shown perhaps that she's more aware than some of the other characters that she's seen, and she believes that love should be a mutual thing. Yeah. She believes that love is not just about the man taking ownership and pleasure of the woman. Love is about a mutual pleasure between two people sharing this thing, right? And actually, even though she's, again, coming back to your original point, even though she's incredibly young, there is a degree of perhaps a mature understanding of love in those words.
Yeah, and like she talks about wanting to possess the mansion of a love. You know, the mansion here is Romeo's body. She's imagining possessing Romeo's body. This is totally different from the patriarchal structures of Veronese and indeed Elizabethan society. She's not imagining being possessed by Romeo, although she does imagine that. She's imagining possessing him as well. It's mutual, isn't it? It's a relationship of equals.
So in your first part, I know you've said a little bit more in here, but we should probably move on because we've spent quite a lot of time on that. So maybe we'll encourage our listeners to go through all your notes on paragraph one.
There's one final point maybe just that I'd like to say. Just
go on then.
It's a little allusion that people might have missed in class. And it's when she talks, her imagery of the sun actually contains in it something that's quite troubling, because when she talks about Phaeton whipping Phoebus, whipping the horses across the sky, she's not talking about the sun god Phoebus Apollo. She's talking about Phoebus Apollo's son. And actually what happens in the Greek myth is that when the sun god Apollo's son takes control of his horses dragging the sun, it's dragged out of control and he crashes and is horribly burned. So actually we've got this hint in the imagery of a relationship that, like those careening horses, is being dragged out of control. That it's beautiful, it's bringing light to the world. This is a relationship that might be crucially cut short. So perhaps it's explained more fully on the sheet, but it's perhaps for some of you really wanting to push your analysis an interesting allusion to unpack.
Intertextuality, you'd call it in media, but
not,
yeah, it's
to dwell on, but like a little nugget for those of you who might be interested in Greek mythology and Roman mythology.
You know, what could be cooler than being interested in Greek and Roman mythology, I would say. Anyway, on to paragraph two.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously in an essay, in an exam, in 45 minutes, you've got probably about, you know, time to write three paragraphs, maybe four if you're really quick. So we've kind of divided most of our arguments into these threes. So our second paragraph is looking at Juliet's agency and desire elsewhere in the play. So the point we've just made is about her desire. And so The topic sentence I've got is Juliet's agency and desire, her relationship with Romeo, is certainly evident even from their first meeting in the play.
And just to clear up agency, because it's a maybe slightly confusing word. What we mean there is that she has sort of control over her life and actions. Yes. You know, your agency is your ability to shape your own way forward, your own path.
Yeah, it's a really useful word when talking about Juliet, because of course it's precisely what most women in you know, in Veronese society, in the world of the play, lack. Most of them are objects.
Yeah.
She has this ability to shape her own path, certainly for a time. And I think the obvious points to look at here is Act 1, Scene 5 and Act 2, Scene 2. And this is some of the exact same points that you would have used if you listened to our earlier episode on love. So we won't dwell too long on them, because you can actually, I would encourage you to go back to that. But we'll gloss briefly over them. And that's, you know, things like in Act 1, Scene 5, the first words they exchange on stage are in a sonnet.
Yes.
And of course, sonnets are associated with love.
And crucially, they create the sonnet together, don't they? They actually, you can see on the stage, and you can see if you look at the text, their words actually combining to form the rhyme scheme within that sonnet.
Yeah, they initially speak separately, then gradually their rhymes come together until the final rhyming couplet in the final two lines of the sonnet, when they kiss. So there's a sense of the form of the poem encapsulating, summing up their relationship. It's also really important that a brief point to note, again, we talked much more about this in our episode on love, that sonnets in Elizabethan society were traditionally written by men to or about women. Women were objectified in sonnets. Shakespeare wrote 154, although admittedly 126 of them were objectifying a man. But we won't dwell on that now.
That's a podcast for another day, maybe.
But the poem has this dialogic structure. It's a dialogue. It's a back and forth. So she has choice. She has a voice, doesn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she immediately, from the moment that they meet, you've already had this hint at this, I think, when you've got the nurse and her mother are sort of talking to her about the match with Paris, and there's this feeling that the nurse regards marriage as about being sexual pleasure and nothing really more, and her mum regards marriage as a transactional thing, a way of climbing up society or cementing your place in the wealthy echelons of society. And we get we suspect that Juliet believes that they're both kind of wrong, that there's more to love than this, and actually love is about the soul, and that the attraction, physical attraction, is a part of it, but actually there's a deeper connection to be sought after. When she first sees Romeo and they create this sonnet together, that is a nice representation. That is a nice through the means of the sonnet, that is a very clear representation that Juliet was right, that there was more to all of this.
Yeah, we see that also in the language, as you have already said, and we could be a bit more specific here. In Act 2, Scene 2, she takes apart, she deconstructs Romeo's metaphors, she gives them meaning. So when he makes this flippant comment saying, I swear on the moon, the blessed moon, she points out that actually the moon is constantly changing. It's an inconstant moon, she says. And she also compares their love. She says she worries that it might be too like the lightning. Again, that's a simile that's suggesting that she's worried about Romeo being like other men, that his love might burn brightly and then immediately disappear, just like lightning. So
imagery that's, of course, echoed by the friar's ideas of fire and powder, of course, as well.
So that's probably all we need for that second paragraph. I mean, we always go on for too long because we get caught up in these interesting rabbit holes. And I think there are a lot to go with, but these are points that, as I said, we've already made in that other podcast, and I think you could quite easily slot them in here. Just evidence earlier in the play that Juliet has agency. She's intelligent. She's an equal partner in her relationship with Romeo.
Yeah, absolutely. And that leads us quite neatly onto we've had two quite positive paragraphs, really, haven't we? We've had the first one's a bit kind of bittersweet, isn't it? It's we talk about the power of Juliet, but also the sadness that she's about to be dragged into the tragedy of the play. We've then talked in paragraph two about her agency and power, other moments in the play, but I think in paragraph three, we're going to look at more of the tragic side of her story.
Yeah, because I think where our argument's going really is that Juliet's such an interesting character. I think she's one of Shakespeare's most interesting characters. She seems to escape patriarchy. She seems to escape these structures, but she ultimately can't. We see that this is a play that shows the reality of a 13-year-old girl trying to defy her father. the tragedy is that she isn't able to. The only power she has is over her own life and death, ultimately. So
yeah.
So the third topic sentence I've gone for is, however, you know, the tragedy of the play is that while Shakespeare depicts Juliet in a way that makes her seem quite modern to us, she is still ultimately defined by the limits of patriarchal society.
Yes. So ultimately, in a society, as all these qualities that Juliet has, all of this wisdom beyond her years, all of this belief in a different, more mature kind of love, all of this fact that she even brings meaning to language where Romeo could not, all of that is less powerful than the patriarchal society that she finds herself in.
Yeah, and we might flip this on its head in our conclusion. I think there is space for maybe a bit of positivity in our conclusion, or negativity, depending on what kind of person you are. But I think we need to look at Act 3, Scene 5 here. And again, this is stuff we've already talked about in our podcast on family. So the point Mr. Galley made about there being this crossover between your essays, these points, none of these points will be new to you if you have listened to our previous podcasts. Actually, these are points that we will have argued in our other essays as well. So in Act 3, Scene 5, we see the brutal way in which her father, following the intimacy of the morning after the consummation of her marriage with Romeo, he comes into her bedchamber, Romeo escapes, and he verbally attacks her. You know, we see rhythms. One of my favourite points here is that when he interrupts her with the words, how. And Shakespeare kind of, most of the play is in iambic pentameter. That means there's five beats in a line. It goes da-dum, 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 da-dum. Oh, she don't the torches to burn bright. But here we've got four stressed beats, and we call the pairs of stressed beats, we call them spondees. Again, these words are on your handout if you are interested in the analysis of rhythms. It's called the analysis of prosody if you are a bit of a nerd like me about poetry. But you don't even necessarily need to know the word. The point is that he breaks the rhythms of the speech to interrupt her. And what does this really show us? She loses that voice that she's gained, doesn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. And in a really crude way, right, that he's not breaking her voice with a more eloquent and interesting voice. It's not as if he has vocabulary and poetry that she doesn't have and is able to beat her down like that. He actually beats her down with a simplicity of language, right? And do we perhaps there see the sort of bullheadedness of masculinity? Do we see the sort of the blunt, crude nature of what he's doing?
Hypocrisy, because earlier on in the play, in Act 1, Scene 2, he says that his will to Paris marrying Juliet is only a part. He wants to give her agency. And yet here, when Juliet says she won't marry Paris, he just immediately becomes so angry. And his metaphors are also important here. He calls her green sickness carrion, like she's this rotting animal. She calls her baggage, as if she's a weight weighing him down.
Yeah.
And he even talks, the most disturbing one that we did talk about extensively on the other episode, we won't hear, is he talks about fettling her, tying her up and dragging her to church on a hurdle. And you'll remember that a hurdle was, of course, in early modern society, the way in which a traitor was dragged through the streets of London on a hurdle before they would be hanged, drawn and quartered. So that she's being compared to this traitor. She's being prepared to, you know, marriage here is, in this metaphor, is an execution. She is, you know, it shows her complete powerlessness, doesn't it?
It does. It absolutely does. And it is hugely, hugely tragic and a fantastic means of breaking the idealism that the audience might have fallen into. What I mean by that, I suppose, is that we want to believe in the success of Romeo and Juliet's love. We know, of course, it's a tragedy right from the prologue, from the initial words of the play. But in spite of that, I think you still want to believe in it, don't you? You still want to believe in the power of this love, that it might somehow win over, even though we know that it won't. And it's Shakespeare it's incredibly interesting the way Shakespeare shows us how easily that is broken by this sort of idiot man in his powerful position.
Unfortunately, much like our society today, but that's maybe another one for another day as well. And I think the point about Act 3, Scene 5 is just the very end of this scene. She says the only power she has, if all else fail, myself have power to die. The only power she has is over her own body.
Right. And ultimately, yeah, the only choice I have is the choice to end this.
We see this in Act 5, Scene 3, when she does kill herself. She unable to get the poison from Romeo's dead lips, she takes his dagger and stabs herself in what some critics see as like a parody of The Wedding Night, impaled by his dagger, lying side by side in a tomb rather than a wedding bed.
That look at what should have been a beautiful union between two people has become a brutal and savage, unnecessary ending.
I think maybe, like, just as we're running out of time, the final point for me just is my favorite line in the whole play, the rhyming couplet that turns the title on its head, is just that if we are going to find some kind of positivity in this play, the patriarchs don't really learn a lesson. Montague and Capulet just agree to build gold statues of the pair of lovers as if that will somehow bring them back to life. But the epilogue of the play, which is spoken by the prince, says this: "For never was a story of more woe than this of Juliet and her Romeo." So whilst Montague and Capulet seem to have learnt nothing, the prince, the character who's also mourning the death of Mercutio, his cousin, he's learnt that actually Romeo belonged to Juliet. This was not simply a patriarchal experience, but this was a relationship perhaps that showed us something different from the rest.
And I wonder if you could read even deeper into it than that and say that, is there an imagining there that if it had been Juliet and her Romeo, maybe the story would not have been of one of such woe? The fact that it was the final rhyming couplet gives this idea of what if it was Juliet and her Romeo? Well, then maybe if that was the world they lived in, then it wouldn't have worked out so terribly. Maybe the whole fact that it was Romeo and Juliet, you know, the idea of the patriarchy and of male ownership was what caused the whole state of affairs.
Not necessarily a rabbit hole for your essays in an exam, but it's certainly an interesting one to think about. So conclusions, really, I think, are best left to you, really, because the conclusion is the space to be personal. What's your response to Juliet? What do you think about her? What does the play make you feel? What about its relevance in the 21st century? It's where I actually encourage students to often use the first person, even, and think about, you know, how do you respond to Juliet? What is her tragedy? You know, I think that we've put a few questions on the handout for you to think about, but that's really, I think, enough from us. We've banged on for 31 minutes, and I think that's
more. I think so. I think as either of our wives would testify, that is far, far too long to be listening to us. So I think it's a good place to wrap it up. You can connect with us on Twitter at @GRevisionPod. You can email us at, what's the email address, Mr. Forster?
EnglishRevisionPod@gmail.com.
EnglishRevisionPod@gmail.com. We love getting your emails. Thank you very much. We've had some brilliant ones. We've had some brilliant ones recently. So please send us in. please send us in any questions, any ideas that you might have. And as I said, we are going to try and get plenty of these done in 2021 for you. All right. I hope you all have a happy new year, and we will see you again very soon on English GCSE English Revision Pod.